All right. Welcome everyone, and it's good to see you all, Zany, Henry, Toby, and Erwin on the phone. And just dedicate our learning for continuing for Shalema, for Judd, and for his daughter. Thank God the kidney transplant. I was on the phone with him. It went well, and he's recovering. But we'll dedicate our learning, hopefully, for a continued Rufua Shalema that all should go well.
Amen.
So we find ourselves in Zion Amud Beis on 7B, and we left off. There's like a few one-liners here. We left off with a one-liner, which told us. I'm not sure if it's either at the end of the first section or the beginning of the second section of the Art Scroll, if I had to guess. Abaye bar Oven, Rechanina bar Oven, Mechalti Sudu Sayu Lehadadi. That Abaye bar Oven and Rechanina bar Oven, they would exchange meals with each other. Now, what does it mean to exchange meals? So one is, like Toby, you pointed out last time, Rashi says that ze ochel im ze b'prum shel shana zo, ubishnia so soid chaver ima. So what happened is that they spend 1 year at the first guy's house for the suda, and the next year they'd spend the meal at the other guy's house for the suda. However, there's another interpretation which Henry you alluded to last time, and this I found who says it. The Rambam in Hilchos Megillah, Perek Beis, Halacha Tesvav. So you just got to look up the reference in the it gives you the reference here on the side. So he writes, Vim Inlo, if you don't have many resources, like perhaps a yeshiva bachur learning in Eretz Yisrael, Machlif im chavero, zesholeach lezesudaso. They could just exchange meals with each other. So if I had a meal I was planning on eating, a small meal, and you had a small meal, and we're pressed for limited resources, we can exchange meals with each other. And where did Rambam get this from? Rambam infamously doesn't give us citations, but if you look in the Maggid Mishnah, the Maggid Mishnah says he gets it from Daf Zayin, our Gemara. Tani Rav Yosef, Mishloach Mas Yishra Yehu, Shnei Matos Le'echad, Abaye Rechanina, Mechal V'Yisidu Dadi. So our case. So the Rambam says, unlike Rashi, who says that it's a meal 1 year at his house, the next year at the other person's house, rather it was the same parm and they were exchanging meals with one another. We're not going to get into it now, but there is a question that the Lechem Mishnah brings up about how Mishloach Manos worked according to Rashi, because whoever was hosting, okay, he provided Mishloach Manos by hosting the meal for one of his for the person he was hosting. But how was the other one Mekayim Mishloach Manos? So that commission gives an answer. There's other answers to reconcile Rashi, but this is from last year, so we're not going to elaborate on that for now. So we're going to go to the next part of the Gemara, which is perhaps one of the most famous lines in the Gemara, when it comes to Hilchos Purim. Amar Rava, Michaev Inish Lipsumi Bepuria Adlo Yada Bein Aror Haman Lebaruch Mordechai. Rava says that a person is obligated to get himself inebriated on Purim until the point that he cannot distinguish between saying, cursed is Haman and blessed be Mordechai. There is so much literature on this one line. Every rabbi and his grandmother has something to say about it. You know, it's like it's akin to when we had that line. So I guess that's it. If you bring in Bumpy, actually, I'm sure she'll have something to say on it.
I
Now,
wonder if your grandmother, what she has to say about it.
so this is akin to the line that we saw earlier in the Masechta about how Rashi and Levi, just a one-liner saying that women are also obligated in the midst of Mikra Megillah. And you remember, we had a whole Monday night shiur just on that topic alone. So this one-liner has a lot of literature. We, God willing, we will have some time at the end, and we'll go through, I think, at least five different interpretations of what this line means. But for now, we'll just translate it kipshuto, which is that one is supposed to get themselves absolutely drunk to the point that they can't distinguish between who the protagonist and the antagonist of the Megillah is. And you look in Tosos on the top, a really small, short Tosos. Tosafot says, quoting Yerushalmi, that you also say, we are all supposed to say, and we say this at the end, Shoshanas Yaakov, Arura Zeresh, Brucha Esther, cursed be Zeresh, the wife of Haman, blessed be Esther, Arum Kol Rishayim, cursed be all the wicked, Bruchim Kol Yehudim, blessed be all the Jews. It's kind of funny, actually. It's it juxtaposes Jews and the wicked. Can there be good non-Jews also? So, okay, we'll leave that for another time. So the next Gemara is actually a really interesting story. And it might sound like just another random tidbit, but we'll make a connection momentarily. Rabbi Rabbi Zera of the Sudas Purim Adi Adadi. Rabbi Rabbi Zera had a Purim Suda together. If some, they got drunk, just like Rava would want them to. Come Rabbi, Shachtel Rabbi Zera. Rabbi got up while he was in his inebriated state, and he killed Rabbi Zera. Lamachar, he wakes up the next day, and he's like, oh, what have I done? So what did he do? He prayed to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu revived him. Wow, that's pretty neat, actually. You know, imagine we're able to learn how to do that. Lishana, the next year, Amar Lei Nisni Marvin Navit Sudas Purim. So next year, Rabbi Sitzra and Zera, hey, that was about the Adani, let us have another Suda again together. Amar Lei, Lobachol Shaita Misrakish Nisa. We got lucky last time. Let's not push our luck. You know, I don't know if you'll be able to revive me this year if you kill me again. So this is a very interesting story, a humorous story, a thought-provoking story, and there's a few points here. One point is the Ben Yoyada, and I think others also note, that there's an interesting question in terms of Hilchos Kiddushin and Gerushin, or more Kiddushin. So what happens? Rabbi Zera died. Rabba prayed to bring him back to life. I have a question. Is Rabbi Zera still married to his wife, halachically? He did die. When a man dies, there's two ways to end a marriage, either through divorce or through death of a spouse, death of the husband. So what happened here? Presumably, the marriage ended because he died. Okay, he was brought back to life. So did he have to be Mekadesh, his wife, again? Did he have to redo the Kiddushin? So the Ben Yoyada, he points to Har Sinai, just Gemara Maseches Shabbos, that says that when God began to speak during the first two commandments, our souls left our bodies, and then they returned shortly thereafter. So similar question over there. We don't know the Jews having to redo their Maisa Kiddushin, if they did a Kiddushin before Matan Torah anyway. So he uses that as a precedent to say that Rabbi Zera did not have to redo the Kiddushin, did not have to remarry his wife. There's an interesting discussion, but why would he have to remarry his wife? So all this assumes the story state. Yes, that is correct, Henry. There's different ways to understand this story, but we're going to take it literally for now. And I'll tell you why it's especially important to take it literally to its extreme. Why did the Gemara want to make such a strong point with this story? You know, the Gemara is not just trying to give us interesting stories so we can keep ourselves up during a Gemara Shir, but it's to convey a lesson. And here we need to look at the story in its context. What was the halacha we learned before the story? That you should get drunk on Purim. What did the story tell us? The consequences of getting drunk on Purim. If I'm not mistaken, the Beis Yosef, and I think the Meiri, they say that this Gemara, this story, comes to tell us not to practice like Rava. It comes to contradict Rava's ruling. That one should not get absolutely inebriated to the point that they lose a sense of who's good and who's bad, and to the point that, God forbid, they can do terrible things. Because it could lead to terrible averos if somebody gets drunk. And if, in fact, you look at instances in the Torah, when people drink and get drunk, it only leads to bad things. You think about Noah coming off of the Teva. The first thing he does is he wants to plant a vineyard. That leads to bad things. And you just look at story after story with people drinking wine. Now, let me just mute where the noise is coming from. So why is it then that we drink on Purim? presumably the most readily available reason is that the Nisan, the miracles of the Megillah came through drinking wine. All the Suvas that took place, it talks about how they were Tov Lev, how the wine helped move things along. And so we drink some wine in order to recall that. But by the way, it may very well be that the wine that we drink is not an absolute chiyuv, but it's just an element to enhancing the Suda. Because remember, we have four mitzvahs on Purim. We have Mikra Megillah. We have the Sudas Purim, Matanas of Yonah, gifts to the poor, and Mishloach Manos. So where does wine fit in? Wine is a part of the Suda. It's lecharchila, but if one did not drink wine, you still fulfill the mitzvah of Sudas Purim. Now, interesting question, does one have to have bread for the Suda, for it to have a din of a Suda? So
Rabbi,
presumably, yes. Is that Phyllis?
Yes.
How you doing?
Okay. Where does this come from? I remember this quote, Nichnas Yayin Yetzei Sod, or something like that.
Nichnas, I think it is in the Gemara. So Phyllis is quoting Nichnas Yayin Yetzei Sod. There's an idea that wine goes in, secrets come out. Let me get you the precise. Well, actually, you can really interpret it more than one way. Let me just get the...
Well, it doesn't mean Kiddush wine, I'm sure.
It's Rabbi...
It's in the Gemara. It's in Sanhedrin.
Lamed Chesam and Aleph.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so it's a Lamed Chesam and Aleph in Sanhedrin. Very good.
I admit I looked it up. I did not know that off the top of my
head. I just looked it up myself also. I just typed it in and saw which Gemara
came
up.
What is that referring to?
I have to look back at the context, but you can really understand one of two ways, I think. One is that some people have a hard time expressing themselves, and a little bit of wine helps them express their true feelings and insights that are very deep down. Another way is that people, when they lose inhibition, they reveal secrets that they ought not to be doing. So, you know, there's a trade-off. And that's why some might say, what's ad lo yada, ad lo ad bechal? You know, until you get to that point, but not quite at that point. Don't go over that threshold. Well, you know what? Let's go forward in the Gemara. There's a number of interpretations of what it actually means, and I'd love to go through a few of them. Let's just make sure we make it through the Gemara first, and then we'll get to the extra mefarshim. But these are all great questions, and thanks for referencing that Gemara, Phyllis, and Henry for looking. Okay. Going forward, so this Gemara seems to be a cautionary tale against drinking too much, maybe even a contradiction to Rava's ruling. Amar Rava, one final ruling from Rava about the Sudas Purim. Amar Rava, Sudas Purim she'achah b'layla l'yotzei chovaso. If one has their meal on Purim night, one has not fulfilled their mitzvah of having a Sudas Purim. My taima. Because it says in the Megillah, Yemei Mishta Usimcha Ksiv. It says days of drinking and of Simcha. And we see from here that the mitzvah of drinking, meaning of having a Suda, which includes the element of drinking wine, arguably it could be other alcoholic beverages as well, by the way. But let's just say wine for argument's sake. So then that can only be filled during the daytime. So that's why there's no mitzvah, you know, people that once they hear it's Purim, like, now it's socially acceptable to be like drinking a lot in public. So they already start doing it at nighttime, but actually the mitzvah is only during the daytime. Is it throughout the entire day or just during the Suda? So that also, I believe, is up for discussion. Moving forward, Rav Ashi, so this is a continuation. Rav Ashi, Rav Yosef, Kamid, Rav Kahana, Nagel, Asur, Rav Anan. So what happened was daytime came and no one showed up to the base medrash. Amarlay, my time, Rabbanan. He said, wait, why is no one showing up to the base medrash today? So he replies, maybe they're busy eating the Purim meal. That's why you don't see him in the base medrash right now on Purim day. Amarlay, could they not have just had their Sudas Purim the night before, that way they could come to yeshiva on time the next day? Look what he's assuming. Like, if you're not having the per meal, you should be learning otherwise. Amar le, lo shmiele the marhad amar Rava suus perm shach le lo yasin chavaso. Did you not learn the ruling that Rava gave, that if one has a suddas porim at night, they have not fulfilled the mitzvah of suddas porim? Amar le, amar Rava, did Rava actually say this? Amar le, indeed he did. And so therefore, tanamine arbain zimnen udami le keman de manach bekise. Therefore, he taught him this din 40 times until it was like something that someone puts inside their purse, meaning you're always checking how much is inside your purse, and it should be as you're constantly checking how much money you have, you're constantly counting how many dollar bills you have, so it should be something as readily available as the amount that you have inside your wallet. And so he learned from 40 times until he had such a familiarity with the ruling that it was Shagur B'Piv, he knew it whenever somebody would ask him. And that brings us to the next Mishnah. So I need to give you all a trigger warning, not a real trigger warning, but just to brace you. A lot of what we are going to be seeing for the next little while here has nothing to do with Purim, actually. But if you recall, in our previous Mishnah, it was basically talking about the distinction between one thing and the other thing. And so what our current Mishnah is going to be doing is it's going to continue that theme. These are called the Ein Bein Mishnayos. There's no difference between A and B except for this one detail. And rather than me talk about it in generalities, why don't we look at the Mishnah? Ein bein yom tov l'shavus ela ochel nevesh milvan. Right, because I think previously we contrasted Adar Rishon and Adar Sheni. I believe that was our previous Mishnah, right? Adar Rishon, Adar Sheni, ela kriyas Megillah matzas yom. We said the only difference between the first month, second month of Adar is the reading of the Megillah matzas yonim, and we said other mitzvahs of Simchas Purim as well. So we're continuing in that tradition of the ein beins. Once we started distinguishing between two similar categories in halacha, the ensuing Mishnayos are just going to keep going down that tangent. So we're used to having tangents in the Gemara. Here is a tangent in the Mishnayos, which, of course, that means the Gemara is not going to deal with Mikra Megillah. So Shabbos and Yom Tov are very similar to each other, but the one fundamental distinction between Shabbos and Yom Tov, there's more than one fundamental distinction, really, but perhaps the most salient one is that on Shabbos, one cannot cook. One is not allowed to do malacha that pertains to preparing food. But on Yom Tov, as you know, one is allowed to cook on Yom Tov. So why? Because there is a provision given in the Pasuk for Ochel Nefesh. If you look at the side of your Gemara, the Torah HaShalem, it should be the second Pasuk on the page. It says, "Uvayom harishon mikra kodesh, uvayom hashvi mikra kodesh yelechem. Kol malacha le'asebahem. You shall not do any malacha on these days of Yom Tov. Ach asher yachel lechol nefesh ulevado yaselachem. But when it comes to ochel nefesh, preparing food that people benefit from eating, that is permissible on Yom Tov. And by the way, it's not just eating. We have a principle of mitoch." That the same way I can heat up hot water for drinking, for cooking, so too I can heat up hot water for other uses. And this gets into a whole discussion about heating up hot water for one's body to take a shower on Yom Tov. And I think it's permissible, but I have to be honest and say many think that the best you can do is a lukewarm water on Yom Tov. But I think there's a reasonable basis to say hot water. And we'll leave that for a separate share. Okay, that's the end of the Mishnah. Any questions on the Mishnah that we can clarify? Okay, good. That was straightforward enough. There are other distinctions, by the way. For instance, Hotzah on Shabbos and Yom Tov. The carrying on Yom Tov, not being an issue, not requiring an Erev. You look in Tosos, the second Tosos says, is talking about Malachos here. But there's other distinctions. For instance, if you violate Shabbos, you get stoned to death. But if you violate Yom Tov, you don't get stoned to death. It's alive. So again, violating the Torah is a bad thing. But if you violate Yom Tov, they're not going to stone you for it. So there's other distinctions between Shabbos and Yom Tov. But in terms of malacha, this is the most salient. Very good. Now to the Gemara. So in general, we're probably familiar with these terms. So it's good to rehash. There's something that's called a mitzvah and something that's called a hechsher mitzvah. So mitzvah is the actual mitzvah that you're doing. Let's say a bris milah, bringing a knife through Rosh Hashanah and bringing the knife to the bris or sharpening the knife to prepare for the bris. That would be what we call a hechsher mitzvah. It's not, there's no mitzvah intrinsically to sharpening the knife, but it's to enable a mitzvah, to facilitate a mitzvah. Just I'll make my shout out now for our Sefer HaChinuch here that we started not this Sunday morning, but next Sunday morning. The first mitzvah in Sefer HaChinuch is what? Period of Arivia, reproduction. So getting married, by the way, is not a mitzvah, but getting married, presumably, is a hechsher mitzvah. The mitzvah is having children. And even that, you know, we could still parse out more details from there. But getting married enables one to have the children through a permissible means. So that's interesting, a mitzvah versus a hechsher mitzvah. So the implication of the Mishnah is that on Yom Tov, you're allowed to do malacha for actually making Ochel Nefesh, but Mashiri Ochel Nefesh, the step beforehand, the enabler, even on Yom Tov, that's not permissible. Masisa Delikar Yehuda. And therefore, from here, we see that our Mishnah is not in accordance with Rabbi Yehuda. The Tanya, for there is a machlokus in the following Braisa. Ein ben Yom Tov l'Shabbos ela Ochel Nefesh. That the Braisa, the first thing the Braisa says, like what we saw in our Mishnah, the only distinction between Shabbos and Yom Tov is whether one can do malacha for the purpose of preparing food. Rabbi Huda Mater, af makshir yochel nefesh. Rabbi Huda ever takes a step further than our Mishnah, and he says, even makshir yochel nefesh, one is allowed to do on Yom Tov. Okay, well, is this an arbitrary machlokus? No, they have reasons for why they hold what they hold. My time at the Tanakama, Amar Kra, who velo makshira. If you look at the pasuk we referenced earlier, it said, so who velo makshira? That means only things that are directly involved in preparing the food, not the enablers. Well, but how do they translate? Maybe there's a better English word. How do they translate makshira in the art scroll?
Toby. Very strangely, the word preliminaries.
Preliminaries, yeah.
Okay, so
very strange word.
Yeah, you know, there's certain words that are like only good in the original language. So that's the best we can do. Okay, Raihuda Amar, what's Raihuda's reasoning that he permits even machshirei ochel nefesh? Because it says lachem in the pasuk for you. Lachem lechol tzorcheichem, for you, for all of your needs, even the preliminaries. Ve'idach nami haksiv lachem. So what did the Rabbanan do with the word lachem? Did they just ignore it? Nope. Lachem, what does lachem come to tell me that it's for you? Lachem v'lo la'odei kochabim. Lachem v'lo la'klabim. For you and not for idol worshippers. For you and not for dogs. Oh, well, you can see that there's a, I don't know if it's equating dogs and idol worship, maybe it is, not for me to say. But this is the halacha that on Yom Tov, one is not supposed to invite a non-Jew over. Because the provision to cook on Yom Tov is to enhance the Yom Tov for those who are obligated to practice Yom Tov. Since not pagans, non-Jews, since your pet is not obligated to keep Yom Tov, they don't get to benefit from the cooking of the Yom Tov. And you're not allowed to cook for them on the Yom Tov. If you made something earlier, in theory, you can give to them. But that's the issue with having a non-Jew come to the meal, is that if you're cooking extra for them on Yom Tov, it can lead into problems. How can you do it with the Eved? Is there a reason to be lenient? We could discuss that another time. But that's the idea and principle. V'idach nami haksivu. But what's right you're going to do with the fact that it says who in the pasuk as a limitation? So, ksiv, who, ksiv lachem, you're right. It says hu, which seems to be limiting, and says lachem, which seems to be expanding. So ka b'machshir she'eshra atzus me'erv yom tov, ka b'machshir she'eshra atzus me'erv yom tov. What's the distinction? When am I allowed to do a hechshir for ochel nefesh, a preliminary, an enabler, a facilitator, whatever we want to call it? It depends if it was doable before Yom Tov. If I was able to do it before Yom Tov, then I should do it before Yom Tov. I shouldn't do it on Yom Tov. If it's something I can only do on Yom Tov day, then I do it on Yom Tov day. So we try to keep to this, but the argument that why one should be able to do all sorts of cooking on Yom Tov, any not for Machshir, but for the actual Ochel Nefesh, we try to be Machshir, not to cook on Yom Tov. But the argument is that there's nothing like having food freshly made. If I made the food before Yom Tov and I put it in the fridge and then I heat it up the next day for lunch, it's just not the same as actually making it fresh the day of, right? If I made an omelet before Yom Tov and then I heat up on Yom Tov morning after davening, so it's just not the same, right? This is Metzius. You don't need me to tell you that, guys, right? Okay. And that brings us to the end of this section of the Gemara. Any questions? Any clarification questions? Just got to cover a little bit more ground. Okay. You know, the nice thing about these Ein Bei Mishnayos that we're going to do is that we're going to get actually, God willing, soon to a discussion about Nidarim, about vows. It's just like a very nice slice of different Yedios Kalya, general principles that are good to know. So we covered a lot of Purim stuff, so this is a little bit of a break. Now this next Mishnah on Gemara is going to be a throwback to the Makos days. I see many of you were with us during Makos. So it was so useful having learned Makos recently when I went through this, because we're actually going to literally reference a Mishnah from Makos. So that's the beauty of this that we got over here. So it's going to sound very familiar to you, what we're going to be learning very soon. Here we go. Ein Bein Shabbos Yom HaKippurim And if you look at the, we'll get to that soon. Okay, so what's the difference between Shabbos and Yom Kippurim? On Shabbos, you're not allowed to do malacha. On Yom Kippur, you're not allowed to do malacha. You're not allowed to do 39 malachos. So what's the difference? So I violate Shabbos, or I violate Yom Kippur. On Shabbos, I get skila, I get stoned. But on Yom Kippur, if I violate it, rather than beast and put me to death, I get kares, divine excision. So that's the distinction between them. The Gemara says, "Halein tashlumin zevda shavin." But when it comes to restitution, both are the same. What does that mean? So this is our good old friend Kimlei b'deravamine. Remember, we learned back in the Makos days that if I do one sin, I do one sinful action, I should say, that would incur both capital punishment and giving restitution, then I only get the capital punishment, the larger punishment, and I don't have to pay the restitution. Now we could talk about if I want to do tshuva, should I pay the restitution anyway, in order to make sure that I'm good on the scales when I go up to the heavenly court. Okay, another discussion. So this should sound very familiar, guys, right? Can we Ramine? Ring a bell? Okay, good. We're getting some knots. Now, what will be the case in theory? In theory, if I someone has a pile of grain and I kindle it on Shabbos, so at the same time, I'm kindling. That's Pavlara. In our those who learn Mishnahs with us on a daily basis, we went through 39 Malachos recently. That was one of the 39 Malachos. I know we blitzed through it. And so I'm violating Shabbos and I am damaging someone's property at the same time. So I get put to death instead of having to pay the money. Now, and same thing for Yom Kippur. Since on Yom Kippur, I'm going to get kares. Therefore, I do not have to pay the restitution. Money masnisa and Rabbi Nechunya ben Akana. So who is this opinion attributed to? Rabbi Chanunya ben Akana. The Tanya, Rabbi Nechunya ben Akana. Ha'ozes Yom Kippur b'Shabbos. Sorry, Kis Shabbos l'tashlumen. Ma Shabbos is chayv b'nafsho pater min hatashlumen. Av Yom Kippurim is chayv b'nafsho pater min hatashlumen. So basically what our Mishnah said, just like on Shabbos, you get capital punishment instead of having to pay restitution. so too you get kares for violating Yom Kippur in lieu of paying the restitution. Tanan Hassam. Tanan Hassam. Very good. So this is Makos, Chaf Gimel Amud Aleph. This was the second to last daf in Makos. So it should, you know, just don't be, it should still ring familiar to us. It's not that long ago, guys. Tanan Hassam. Kol Chai De Kriza Shalaku, Nifter Mi De Krizasam. Any time that I incur both kares, before we're talking about kares and restitution, tashlumen, now we're talking about what if I'm using to get kares and malchus. So kol chai v'krisus shalaku nifter mi dekrisasa. If I incur both malchus and kares, if Beis Din gives me malchus, if they give me lashes, then I am absolved from the heavenly punishment of kares. Shunamar. That your brother shall be diminished, shall be lowered in your eyes. What is that going to teach us? Once you get Malchus, he becomes like your brother once more. So that is the Hananiah ben Gamliel, that once you get the Malchus, you become like the brother once more, meaning that you are also like a full Jew in the eyes of God once again. You don't get kares. However, on Rabbi Yochanan, Chalukin Alav, Chavir of Arachanan ben Gamliel, it would seem that most rabbis took issue with this and they say, no, you get kares and you get malchus. You get the double whammy. Now, what's we talked about the reasoning back in Malchus, perhaps the Malchus with capital punishment is like a Misa Arichta. It's like one long capital punishment. The kares is not a sure bet. That will happen. So you should get the malchus anyway. But who's to remember at the Chalkimalanav, we talked about who's to say, you know, kares is in God's hands. So who's to say that just because I got malchus, it means God is going to forgive me and God's not going to give me kares anyway. Remember, we had some line in there that was like, did you go up to heaven and ask them and find out that God absolves people of kares once they get malchus? So this is what we discussed toward the end of Malchus. Amar Rava. Okay, so that's the Machlokus. Does Malchus absolve you of Kares? Amar Rava. Aribi Ra. Wait, but Tanina. Why do we bring this up? Because our current Mishnah in Megillah seems to be at odds with the Mishnah in Malchus. Tanina. Ain bein yom kippur l'shavis, v'shezez dono bi de'adam, v'shezez dono bi Kares. What's the only difference between Shabbos and Yom Kippur? That Shabbos, your punishment is in the hands of Beis Din, and Yom Kippur, your punishment is in the hands of God. But Viv Isa, if this is true, then that once you get Malchus, you are Potter, then I bide Adamu. Wait a minute then. Sorry, once you get Malchus, you still get Kari. So what's the issue then? So it would seem that both are, let me repeat that. Once you get Malchus, you don't get Kares. So then it would seem that both are in the hands of man in Beis Din. For Shabbos, Beis Din gives you capital punishment. For Yom Kippur, Beis Din will give you Malchus. And once they give you Malchus, you are absolved from Kares. But the fact that our Mishnah says otherwise, our Mishnah says Shabbos is Bidei Adam, Shabbos is in the hands of man. But Yom Kippur is kares, meaning it's not in the hands of man. That would seem to show us that it's not true that when you get malchus, you don't get kares. Because then why would the mission be telling me I get kares? Presumably, Beis Din will give me malchus for violating Yom Kippur, so then it's bidei adam, similar to Shabbos. So how do we square these with each other? So two answers. One, Amar Nachman, ha money. Right, Yitzchaki. It's a third opinion of the Gemara from Makos. The Shita Rabbi Yitzchak, Damar Malchus Bechayvei Krisus Leika. He holds that fundamentally, once you get Kares, you don't get Malchus. The Tanya, it's a Gomer Chayvei Krisus Bechal Hayu. Lama Yatzis Kares Bechal. So why did the Torah specify Kares a second time for incest with one sister? But Duna Bechares Lama Malchus to emphasize that when one incurs kares, they don't also get malchus. So now we can make sense of our mission. Of our missions in accordance with Rabbi Yitzchak. Because Reizen says you can only get Kares, you cannot get Malkus. So that's why our Mishnah said that Shabbos is in the hands of Beis Din, Yom Kippur is the hands of heaven. Why? Because there's no Malkus if you're already getting Kares, according to Rav Yitzchak. That's one answer. The second answer is we don't need to attribute our Mishnah to the minority position of Rav Yitzchak. Rather, Rav Ashi Amar, Afilatim Rabbanan. We can even attribute it to Rabbanan, who say that you get both Malkus and Kares. How do we make that work? It says I get Kares in the Mishnah. It doesn't say anything about getting a punishment from Beis Din. The answer is, Zekers don't obey them, and Zekers don't obey Kares. What does it mean that Shabbos is in the hands of Beis Din and Yom Kippur is in the hands of God? What it means is that primarily, the primary punishment that I'm supposed to get is Kares, but if I get Malkus, I still will, that's still in the hands of Beis Din, but the primary punishment I'm getting is Kares, even if I get absolved from it. So we consider Yom Kippur to be in the hands of heaven, even though practically speaking, I may very well get Malkus from Beis Din and thus be Pater from Kares. So this Gemara was pretty much in Malkus, actually. Hopefully, I'm not re-traumatizing everyone. For those who didn't, that one didn't sit too well. Any questions? That was enough revisiting Malkus. Now I know why we moved on to Megillah. One last little piece over here, just so we could break ground on Chesam and Aleph. The next Mishnah says, it's a very short one. You can see short Mishnah, very short Gemara. There's an idea in the Dharma. I can take a Nedar, I can take a vow. I think that someone is so despicable. I really hate Reuven. I'm going to take a Nedar that I'm not going to be Nedar. I'm going to impose like my sanctions on Reuven and say, I don't want to benefit anything from you. I'm not doing any business with you. So there's two ways we're going to discuss to do that. One is just general. I will not benefit from you, period. The other way to do it is to say, I'm not going to benefit from any of your food. Now, food is very wide-ranging. That includes most items. So what would be the nafkamina between saying, I won't benefit from you at all versus I won't benefit from any of your food? Either just walking through, your field, if you have many acres of field and people happen to cut through them, that is okay. That would be okay only if I swore not to benefit from your food. But if I swore not to benefit from you at all, I wouldn't be allowed to walk through that field. And also, kalim, utensils that are or items that are not used for food purposes, that I would be able to borrow if all I swore was not, if I took an oath not to benefit from any of your food. Rashi, however, points out in a very important qualification, this is only if these kind of items are generally given out without charge. If he's giving you an item for free to borrow, even though it would usually be rented out, so then you actually are benefiting even from food, so to speak, because the money you save could go towards purchasing food. And so that actually would not be permitted. Even if he said, I wasn't going to have any food from you, that actually falls under food because I can use the money to buy food. Where else do we see this concept? Interesting. I think I saw a discussion about giving money to someone from a Shalach Mano so that they could go buy food for themselves. And there's a discussion whether you could be Yotzei with Shalach Manos by giving someone food to buy it for themselves. So similar idea there. Let's finish up the Gemara. But of course, if certain kalim are used for the purpose of preparing food, then whether you swore not to benefit, whether you swore not to benefit from the food, from food items, it would be usher for you to use utensils that are meant for making food. Drisa Saregel, last part of the Gemara. So what does it mean that I would be able to walk through his field? Halo kapti inchi. What are people not makbid on someone walking through the field? Amar Rava, ma money, Rabbi Eliezer to Amar vitur aser b'motor hana. So what's Rava tell us here? This is according to the sheet of Rabbi Eliezer, that even though I'm generally not mocking on people walking through my field, nonetheless, even though I generally, you know, don't enforce, nonetheless, to allow you to walk through my field is still considered to be nana, to be benefiting from it. Okay, that brings us to the end of the Gemara there. Now, just briefly, I want to, I cheated and just went to the back of the Sifta, which gave a whole list of different approaches. I want to come back to the question of drinking on Purim. So what does it mean when Rava said that you should drink ad lo yada? So one understanding is, and I believe it's the Rana says, that, yeah, you should just get absolutely drunk. However, there are a few other approaches. One, which I believe it's codified in the Ramah, the Meiri mentions it, that you should drink enough until you get drowsy and until you fall asleep. But it doesn't mean you should get absolutely drunk and start slaughtering people. The Sefer Eshkol has a very interesting point. He says that there was a piyut. There was this song that people would sing that the lyrics were Arur Haman and Baruch Mordechai. And so it doesn't mean you're going to forget who was the antagonist, who was the protagonist of the Megillah. You're not getting that drunk, but you're basically just getting a little bit inebriated, a little tipsy, to the point that you might flip around a few words accidentally while singing. That is much lower threshold than being absolutely drunk, that you forget that Haman's the bad guy and Mordechai is the good guy. There's a few other answers pertaining to doing gematrias. There are a few more. One interesting one, which is mentioned by, it's called Nefesh Chaya. So he says that Akidesh lo yavchin bein oivosh ze'or hamad, it doesn't mean literally Haman and Mordechai, but it means you won't be able to distinguish between Mordechai, the people who you love, and Haman, the people who you despise. That even the Hamans in your life become like Mordechais to you. So that's what it's actually coming to say. That's more Al Pi Drush. But so basically there's different interpretations, different people who there's basically two ways to go about this. You can either interpret Rava's statement and mitigate the implications by saying, oh, it doesn't mean to get that drunk. It means to get like a little tipsy and fall asleep, or you mix up a song. That's the technical way to address it. The more fundamental way to attack it is to say that, no, the next story in the Gemara, which says that if you get drunk, you're going to wind up killing people, is actually fundamentally rejecting Rava's statement. So rather than reinterpreting Rava to fit with how we want things to work, we can just reject Rava altogether. So those are the two main approaches that are given in the Rishonim and in the Yahu. Okay, any questions?
Yeah, something occurs to me. We have to daven three times a day. You get drunk, how are you going to daven properly?
So that's actually why we daven mincha earlier. You daven mincha earlier. You know, it's like also on Simchas Torah, why we do Berachas Kohanim in the morning. So we do Berachas Kohanim at Shacharis in the morning because I guess we know that there's going to be all the Kiddush clubs going on and people are going to be having shops, and we can't have the Kohanim do Berachas Kohanim when they're inebriated or when they even drink. Right, Sadie?
Yeah, but you don't just sober up the minute Purim is over. We're going to have Ma'arav, and that's scheduled.
Yeah. There's different levels of being intoxicated. So some might be, you know, absolutely you're not Yotzei davening. Some are not so good. But the thing is, you know, Marv, you don't have to daven immediately. Marv, you have all night. So hopefully it's, you know, maybe 2 hours after it takes a kokhavim, maybe then you'll daven Marv. But yeah, certainly that's important to keep in mind.
It depends on when the show schedules the minyan.
Yeah, that's true.
Really, it's true, King.
Yeah, I'm not sure how we scheduled ours. I have to take a look. That's a good reminder, Zadie. Okay, wonderful.
Late.
Toby, yeah?
If you don't mind going back to Makos a bit, turn the page back a bit, because I had so much trouble when we were learning Makos, and now this is reminding me how much trouble I was having. at the end of where it's discussing Rav Ashi and so on. And in the art scroll, it says, in this case, the Sabbath, the main punishment for deliberate desecration is punishable by human authority. And in the other case, Yom Kippur, the main punishment for deliberate desecration is with kares. The footnote on that in the art scroll, which is quoting Rashi, says, kares is regarded as the main punishment because it is a more severe penalty than lashes. However, if one committed the sin after having been warned by witnesses that he will be flogged for doing so, he receives lashes, which exempt him from kares. So it almost seems as though you're getting the lashes because it's like that's what was promised to you.
But because what we're saying, according to that shita, is that malchus, technically, if you get malchus, you then get absolved from the kares because you only have to get one punishment. But if categorically speaking, the primary punishment that, because malchus is kind of like a, remember we learned about this in malchus? Malchus kind of is a attached to, you know, a law of dumia lechasima, anything that's similar to the isser of losachsum shor b'disho, of muzzling your animal while it's feeding. Any Isser in the Torah that conforms to those standards, to that paradigm, carries Malchus along with it. So Malchus isn't inherently connected to Yom Kippur. It's just that violating Yom Kippur is alive and it carries Malchus along with it. If I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong, but I think violating Shabbos also would carry a degree of Malchus along with it. But on Yom Kippur,
that would absolve you from the death penalty.
No, it wouldn't. That's the death penalty.
But it just doesn't make sense to me. I mean, Yom Kippur is supposed to be the holy of holies. It's holier than Yom Kippur than Shabbos. So how, you know? I know you're going to say, "Well, kares is worse than death." I don't think so. I mean,
depends how you understand kares.
Well, I'm sorry.
It depends. It's different understandings of what kares is. If kares is a absolute cutting off of the soul.
But then Mako shouldn't be able to absolve you from it.
Well, that actually is very good. And that actually is the debate that we had in the Gemara there, where we're saying, wait, where are you pulling this out from? How do you paskin that Malchus absolves you from kares? Where do you get that from? Like, did you go up to heaven and ask God, does that work? So that actually was a retort in the Gemara. So I think,
So what's our conclusion? Like if we had to.
The conclusion is that we have three opinions that were listed in the Gemara. One is that you get Rabbi Yitzchak, who says you get kares and not malchus. The other opinion was you get malchus and kares, or you malchus absolves kares. So basically any permutation, any of the three permutations.
But I mean, there's no conclusion. There's no law that I, you know, would tell me, if you know, this is.
I think we concluded what? Saying that.
I mean, is there a halachic conclusion?
I think we consider Malchus would absolve the kares. I think that's what we said, but that was, I believe, what the Gemara ended on was saying is that it's it ends on a theological question. It becomes a theological question at the end. But we don't pass on like Rav Yitzchak, as far as I recall. We don't say just because you get kares, you don't get malchus. That was a das yachanan. All right. Well, we'll find out what God holds in terms of kares, God willing, after Mei Aves Rosh Hashanah. All right. Wonderful. Any other questions? All right. Good stuff, guys. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Chodesh Tov, everybody. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Yes, Chodesh.